are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 10th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Bernard Harcourt, author of The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. Also on the program today, no one remotely sane wants to be Trump's chief of staff. Meanwhile, Chuck and Nancy head to the White House, fortunately and hopefully constrained by their now stronger left flank. And on the week of the six-year anniversary of Sandy Hook, new report shows that 2018, the worst year for gun violence in schools in history. Meanwhile, Friday, filings drop against Cohen and Manafort. First off, the Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office, their files document Cohen's felonious activity and directly implicates Donald Trump in that felony. Ain't gonna mean much, but it's nice to know. Manafort filing reveals even a broader range of contacts between administration and transition officials with Russian operatives. Meanwhile, the driver who killed, the Nazi driver who killed Heather Heyer, found guilty of murder coming out of Charlottesville. Trump calls for an even bigger defense budget, now topping $750 billion. Antitrust lawsuit expands to an investigation of price fixing amongst 300 drugs by a pharma cabal. Net neutrality's last chance is days away, and Chicago charter school teachers end their strike successfully. Meanwhile, last week, forgot to mention the Boston Marriott strike is a big win for workers, or could be, nationwide. And lastly, Gavin McGinnis is now officially unemployed. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it's another Friday. Monday. Friday, if I remember correctly, was last week. Michael is out today. He's getting... I don't know what's getting his hair done. It's a hair done day because it's a big week for him. But everybody else is here with bells on. Let me just touch on this news because this is, you know, they say in drama, you want it. You put that loaded gun on the in the drawer at the beginning of Act One, and then it makes everything tense for everybody. And it's a Chekhov. And it makes everything tense for everybody. And we don't want to do that. So let's just get this out of the way. The Proud Boys founder, Gavin McGinnis, apparently has lost his gig with his show, Get Off My Lawn.
Fuck you forever. That's my common quote I say. It's fuck you forever. We're done.
Yeah, that's his common quote he says forever.
Glenn Beck said, get off my network.
Apparently, Glenn Beck. Now, as you recall, last week we reported that The Blaze and CRTV merged. Now, I don't listen. Let me just put it this way. If you work for either one of those entities and you want to tell me stuff about it, you can email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com and tell me stuff, because I'm fascinated. I've done some digging to see if I could figure out who funds Conservative Review. They paid out a massive, massive fee to Mark Stein a couple of months ago, $4 million, in an arbitration hearing. This is from a mediator, so it's not even like a court case. It means that he had to have had a contract at least that big. And there's no way Mark Stein is going to generate that type of revenue for anyone. I'm sorry. And so I can only imagine what these people have been getting paid. And I'm curious if they must have exercised some type of like morality clause or morals clause with Gavin, because otherwise we'd be hearing him about getting paid out. My understanding was no one was watching his show, but he obviously provided them some publicity. Now it appears with The Blaze and CRTV merging that they don't want that kind of publicity anymore. Now, there's some report that Glenn Beck is on the radio right now talking about how he had no idea what was going on. So there's like the Trumpian, like I just got a call that you got fired by Kelly. I can't believe it. I'm really, really upset about this. Of course, I'm not in touch with what's going on.
Isn't he like supposed to be woke now too?
Glenn Beck?
Yeah. That was like,
I think that lasted for a short period of time.
From The Daily Show.
Yeah, I think that was that was like a 3-month period. You know, when your business is going down the tubes, you will attempt to do a bunch of different things. Now, Glenn Beck's business, as you know, contracted, I mean, tremendously over the past 3 years, epically. But he still has a good email list. And so combining with CRTV, which may still have some cash and some shows, who knows? But for whatever reason, Gavin McGinnis is now without a gig on. And so I would say if I'm Gavin right now, I'm doing one of two things. I'm either saying like, well, screw this. I might as well go back to being the white nationalist that I was. But the problem is he doesn't have the ability to make any money off it now.
And there's a lot of heat on that now.
Yeah, he just wasn't. I mean, he wasn't even making money. He wasn't drawing people then. So it's not like he has a big audience. If he had a big audience, he could go do what we're doing. This is easy to set up. I was lucky. I came from Air America. I had an email list of people. I had an audience, and I was able to reach them. Theoretically, right? Gavin has an audience. And to set up a camera and a microphone, he's got this stuff lying around in his basement. So I would suggest to Gavin, go down into your basement. Start doing your show. You're funny, as far as you know. And so so either that'll happen, or Gavin is going to sort of suddenly, like, maybe go into some type of program, you know, and come out the other end and say, I've dealt with my problems, whatever they were, drug, alcohol, insecurity, incontinence, whatever the problem was, I've dealt with it. I've been in an inpatient facility for, 60 days or 30 days. And now I'm coming out and I'm a much more benign guy, and maybe I can get a job at VH1 hosting some weird, sideshow or something.
Yeah. He was just intoxicated for 20 years on the kinds of drugs that turn you into a racist, misogynist piece of shit.
I mean, that may require a 60-day stint to get over, but those are the two options. That's it. So, as you said before, sound drop.
Fuck you forever. That's my common quote. I say it's fuck you forever. We're done.
Yep. There you go. You should have trademarked that. Meantime. Oh yeah. Where are we? Where is my list of, Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, one of today's sponsors is Privacy at privacy.com/majority. Privacy.com is a totally free service. It lets you buy anything online without having to give out your credit card number, and it lets you prevent companies from overcharging you. Here's how it works. You take a couple of minutes to link your bank account to your privacy.com account, and then you're able to create a virtual credit card numbers which are linked to your bank account. You can create as many virtual cards as you want. You can delete them. You can freeze them and unfreeze them. You can set limits on each card. It's great for signing up for free trials because you can just create a virtual card once and delete it knowing you'll never be charged once the trial is over. Not only have I started using this, but I've read up on it quite a bit. And people who are uptight about their credit card information being stolen, about getting overcharged, like I am, give this service big thumbs up. And apparently they get their cut from, you know, more or less like the way credit cards do in terms of a fee. But it doesn't come from the consumer. So it's great for signing up for free trials. You can create a virtual card once, delete it, knowing you'll never be charged once the trial is over. That's also awesome. There's a lot of stuff out there. I'm like, I'll take the 30 days. Check this out. And then you forget. And then, you know, 6 weeks later, you realize, like, I've been charged. You can avoid that. It protects you when companies get hacked and people's information is stolen because you're not giving out your real credit card number. That's extremely helpful. Each card is locked to a merchant, so you're totally protected against fraud and unauthorized use of your card. Privacy.com's mobile app and desktop browser extension make it incredibly easy to manage your wallet of virtual cards and allow you to autofill your virtual card number at a click of a button when you're shopping online. There are countless different advantages to using a service like this to pay your bills and buy things online. You can find out more. Get 100% free and unlimited access by going to privacy.com/majority. That's privacy.com/majority. We have a link in our podcast description and in below our video. Another of today's sponsors, Skillshare. And the first 500 people, I don't think there would be that many left now, but check it out. Who go to skl.sh/majority are going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing to photography, business, technology, cooking, mediation, everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that will be useful to you in both your personal and your professional life. You can sharpen your skills with something you already love doing or learn how to do something that you've been waiting to learn to do, sometimes in my case, for decades. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition. I probably could use that one too. Learning new languages, Photoshop. That one is on my list. You name it. Like I've been mentioning, I was very excited this weekend because I took like one of the I watched the knife cutting course, you know, for a way you do it, chef, and I used some of that technique on an onion this weekend as I made latkes.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Knife cutting 101.
I felt pretty good about it. I think people can probably get a little more ambitious with some of these other courses, but. You get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majority. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. Again, that's skl.sh/majority. I put a link in the podcast description and underneath any video you may watch. Lastly, there is no need to suffer through another sleepless night. I used this product last night. Calming Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that helps you relax so you can fall asleep and stay asleep naturally. 15 pounds. It's designed with high-density comfort fill to provide exactly the right amount of weight to help relax your body. It mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged, helps the production of serotonin and melatonin. You can sleep better, feel great, and stress less. Plus, made with super soft velveteen material, calming comfort is 100% machine washable and dryer safe. That's a big deal. A lot of the comfort blankets that you get, the weighted ones, you can't wash them in the washing machine. That's super annoying. You know what else is great about calming comfort weighted blanket? If you want my son Saul to come in to your bed to sleep with you because he likes your blanket, this is the one to get.
It's not guaranteed, though.
Now, I can't guarantee that. I mean, because I don't know how far he'll walk.
It'll improve the chances.
But let me put it this way. You get one. You have it. I will tell him to go there. Just understand it's going to happen about 5:15 in the morning. Calming Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from the Sharper Image. Right now, for our listeners only, you can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com. That's all one word. Calmingcomfortblanket, obviously then .com. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Receive 15% off the displayed price. That's calmingcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY. And because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep, go online now, calmingcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY for your special discount today. So as we've said, apparently they cannot find anybody to be chief of staff. Look, how long have they been talking about firing John Kelly? I mean, months and months and months. And apparently, Trump was negotiating and has been talking to and assuming that Nick Ayers, the chief of staff of Mike Pence, was going to move over into this position. And it is unclear why Ayers isn't doing it. I've seen a couple of things. One, there's something to do with Greitens. He's got some tied into that scandal. The former governor of Missouri, was it? And there's also people who say, like, he wants to get out of the White House. He doesn't want to be tied to Trump because the stuff is going to come down. And he obviously can't stay and be Pence's chief of staff because Trump's going to be like, wait, what? You turn me down? But you can work for him, not for me. That's no good. So you got to take one for the team. It's a, you know, sacrifice fly. You walk out of the building, essentially. But the Fox and Friends guys, they have another theory as to why no one who in their right mind wants to be even come like within feet of this job.
Well, these jobs are... they're very difficult. The president apparently works around the clock. They don't get paid a lot of money when you consider how expensive Washington, D.C. is. And then you have Nick Ayers, who says he wants to be with his family. He has triplets.
He does. Three 6-year-old triplets.
Young children wants to go back to Georgia. Put hashtag Georgia on the tweet.
Right. It does.
Yeah, he's got Georgia on his mind.
I don't know if he'd be able to keep up.
Incidentally, for some ungodly reason, this young guy, right? Fairly young guy, he's managed to amass. What is it, $30 million in the course of his public service? Wow.
Mike, can I just have you chief of staff? Is that basically what's happened there?
That's basically what happened. Just and he thought, yours. I think at just at one point they realized, like, oh, this isn't going to be good for Pence and for Ayers. It's not going to be good for them. So time to leave the building. But, of course, it's because it's so expensive in D.C. I remember when these guys were going on and on about how difficult it was for people like AOC. They laughed at that notion. And I got news for you. When you go down as a congressperson, you've got to maintain two residences. One in your home district, one in D.C. When you have $30 million, you don't have to go to Georgia. You can bring your family to D.C. when you're working full-time for the White House. So it seems a little bit. And of course, you know, Steve Mnuchin, I think he can afford to live in Washington. Apparently he's turned down the president. Mick Mulvaney's already there.
Wait, Mnuchin was going to be chief of staff?
They offered it to him, apparently. Oh. That's what's being reported.
No.
I don't know.
I don't know if you should do that.
Little close. I don't. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, We're going to be talking to Bernard Harcourt. He is the Isidore and Seville Sulzbacher Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Columbia University, author of The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens.
Up in the autumn branches, built from nothing but high hopes and thin air, collected up some baby blasted mothers. They took their chances, and for a while they lived quite happily up there. He came from New York City, man, but he couldn't take the pace, and thought it was like a dog-eat-dog world. And he went to San Francisco, spent a year in outer space with a sweet little San Franciscan girl. I can hear my mother wailing and a whole lot of scraping of chairs. I don't know what it is.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the Isidore and Seville Sulzbacher Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at Columbia University and author of his latest, The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. Bernard Harcourt, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam Cedar.
Let's start with this this question. Let's start from here. I mean, you write that our government has been in a what you call a state of exception for about 20 years. What does that mean?
Yeah. So, you know, I actually argue that it's become so normalized that what would ordinarily be thought of as a state of exception or as exceptional has just become the way we've come to govern in this country. So what I'm arguing essentially is that since 9/11, we've adopted a new way of governing and controlling society in the United States. And it comes from the way that we started to engage foreign countries in Iraq and Afghanistan and more broadly, but that method kind of has come home to roost. And what I argue is that it's really a form of counterinsurgency warfare that we started to use after 9/11 in our war in Iraq that gradually expanded across military operations and into foreign affairs so that we were starting to use counterinsurgency paradigms outside of the war zone, and that those ways of governing, those ways of controlling populations have come home and have been domesticated, and we're using them at home. And what I'm talking about are the methods of counterinsurgency warfare that basically involve kind of identifying an internal enemy, which, of course, in Iraq or Afghanistan would be the supporters, the originally Al Qaeda, and now we've extended to ISIS. But that mentality of trying to identify that internal enemy and then eliminate it, but also win the hearts and minds of the population, is a way of thinking and a way of governing that we've now transplanted back to the United States, so that now, particularly under the Trump administration, but this was true previously. It's been true since 9/11. We're using this notion of an internal enemy to kind of govern and pacify Americans. And you know, I think you hear it very clearly when President Trump talks so much about the caravan, which is intended to identify a whole set of internal enemies in this country of kind of undocumented, mostly Latino or Hispanic undocumented persons. But more broadly, it becomes kind of Mexican Americans, et cetera. And that idea of an internal enemy, or with the Muslim ban, right? The idea that we had to be so careful about you know, all Muslims, but also American Muslims. And that idea of the internal enemy starts to be what we use to govern in this country. And to quiet us, to quiet the population, to kind of win the hearts and minds of the American people now.
Okay, so let's we should know that I think you started the book and anticipated the book as coming out with a you know during maybe the beginning of a Clinton administration. So Trump's ascendancy has sort of solidified some of your thesis.
Yeah.
Let's go prior to 9/11 and just or give me a sense of the development of this counterinsurgency strategy, because on some level,
sure.
Well, I mean, let do that and then I'll take it from there.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. So, the kind of the counterinsurgency approach was a mode of warfare that really was developed mostly in the 1950s and 60s. I mean, there were precursors of kind of in the Philippines when the U.S. fought the war in the Philippines at the beginning of the 20th century. But really, it was really kind of refined in the 1950s during the colonial uprisings and during the wars of independence in Indochina for the French, or Algeria for the French, Malaya for the British, and of course Vietnam. For the United States. So it was a different way of doing warfare, of being at war, different from the more classical kind of large battlefield style of warfare with strategies that were very different. Sometimes it was called unconventional warfare. Sometimes it was called anti-guerrilla warfare. It came to be known as counterinsurgency warfare. It had a number of names. Some called it modern warfare. But it's this idea of kind of the unconventional way of fighting war, which is when you have a very different kind of enemy.
Right, so and it's asymmetric, right? I mean, that is okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's asymmetric because you're not fighting a large an opponent on a battlefield with, you know, many soldiers or battalions or tanks lined up against you. You're fighting in the brushes, in the bushes, in the wherever it is, in the Kasbah, against an insurgent faction, an armed revolutionary insurgent faction. That's where it kind of came from. In the colonies, mostly.
And Professor, and so we should say that it is almost, I mean, maybe not exclusively, but I think, I mean, you tell me, associated with colonial projects, right? With imperialistic projects. Someone is occupying someone else's country, essentially.
Exactly, right. I mean, this mode of warfare really emerged hand in hand with the colonial enterprise, and it was refined predominantly during the anti-colonial uprisings, and so it's really tied to that notion of having an internal enemy in the population that you are governing, right? The colonial population having a small group of insurgents and having an insurrection. Of course, the theories that were developed. So the theories that were developed in the 1950s by French commanders in Indochina and in Algeria and British in Malaya, people like David Galula or Roger Trinquier, French commanders, or Thompson, the British counterinsurgency commanders. Those were developed against insurrections that had often a Maoist, communist inspiration to them. And so a lot of the strategies that were developed in a very interesting way kind of took Mao's way of thinking about the population and tried, in effect, to do what Mao was doing, but better, against the Maoist insurgents, or just against the, you know, the Viet Cong, for instance. And the idea here was that Mao had been a great strategist. Of course, he'd succeeded in the Chinese Revolution in the late 1940s. So But he had a particular vision of society. And, you know, there are those famous quotes of Mao about the fact that, you know, the insurgents need to swim in the water like fish. And that idea was basically that you had a small group of insurgents that needed to befriend and win the sympathy of a passive majority in order then to expel the what they considered to be the oppressive minority that was maintaining rule in the country. Now, what's really interesting is that the French, the British, the American commanders who adopted counterinsurgency theory basically kind of took hook, line, and sinker, the kind of view that Mao had of society, of there being a small insurrectional group, of there being a passive majority, the passive masses who could go one way or the other, and of a small counter-revolutionary minority as well. And so that vision of the world was essentially adopted by the counterinsurgents, but then, of course, they flipped it upside down in order to then try to, you know, target and eliminate the small minority of insurgents and to win the hearts and minds of the population. Now, that's what developed in the 1950s and 60s as counterinsurgency theory. The RAND Corporation was really important to its development. And it was used, of course, abroad, only intermittently successfully. I mean, it was used very much, for instance, in Algiers, during the Battle of Algiers, to wipe out the FLN at that point. But, of course, they lost the war, so it wasn't ultimately successful. But it had certain techniques that were involved, so use of torture. For purposes of interrogation, getting information. I mean, you have to get total information on the population, not just on the people that you're targeting, because you need to be able to distinguish that small active insurgency from the general population. So you want these forms of total information awareness, which, for instance, in Algeria was done with torture. You want to really target heavily and brutally that small minority, and that was done through forms of basically summary executions, people being thrown out of helicopters into the Mediterranean, and you wanted to work on the population, which was the idea of the hearts and minds, what developed in Vietnam as the hearts of the work that's called hearts and minds, trying to win over the population and their sympathies. Those strategies were kind of refined during those colonial and anti-colonial wars. Then after 9/11, what I would argue is that we then turned to those strategies after 9/11 and refined them more and started expanding them and ultimately bringing them home and domesticating them.
And so I remember during those early years of the Iraq War hearing stories that they were playing Battle of for Algiers
in the Pentagon
and
right.
To a certain extent Donald Rumsfeld wanted to change our military to reflect this new reality where this post Cold War reality where we're going to be going in and we're going to be, from the perspective of the Maoists, we're going to be the minority oppressors of, and it's basically just, two factions on one side of a sort of a passive middle, I guess, extensive middle that aren't willing to pick up a gun on either side, essentially, but might provide food support or something.
Yeah, eventually the kind of consent and legitimacy that a government needs really to run. In the end, governments do need acceptance on behalf of the vast majority of the population. Otherwise, they just can't function properly. And so it's that winning that kind of the passive masses that on this theory is what matters most. Now, and at the beginning, you were entirely right. I mean, to return to, you know, the Rumsfeld era, the early era post 9/11, we did see precisely the kind of techniques that had been used in Algeria being used by U.S. Forces and by the CIA. So the extensive torture of those captured, including actually when you compare some of the use of torture, it was even more brutal. I mean, for instance, the Senate torture report found that on one suspect, water was administered 183 times. I mean, 183 applications of water.
Yeah,
during waterboarding, which was much more extensive actually than what was used in Algeria, but so these different strategies come together of trying to get total information, which was also done through NSA programs like PRISM and Upstream, et cetera.
At one point in 2002, there was an attempt to institute TIPS, I guess, which was a total information total information. I can't remember what it stood for.
Program.
But
right.
at one point,
right.
they were going it to have postmen and cable service people, when they come into your house, basically report on you if you had, like, you know, the functional equivalent of a Che Guevara poster hanging in your apartment. All right, but let me ask you this. So who, when we say we've adopted these things, who are those entities, and by what manner? And I would also add, maybe I'm loading up this question too much, but in the scenarios that we're talking about, there's a pretty clear insurgency, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the oppressive, there's the people who are that come into the country and try and take over the country, and then there's a pretty clear insurgency. We know who they are because they're blowing up things, or they're taking over depots, or they're, you know, destroying a bridge, or controlling a bridge in the countryside. What's the process in which we manufacture that?
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot in that question.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Let me just hit a few things, and try and give you the arc of my argument here. You started by talking about the we. Who is the we? You know, and that's a tricky one, because let me just start by saying, and then I'll explain a little bit the trajectory. But I don't want to always be pointing fingers at other people and always talking about, you know, they doing this to us or something, because in large part we're a part of all of this way of governing, and even, you know, even when we're protesting, I mean, the fact that, you know, we're not protesting enough to end this in some way makes us all, I feel, somewhat kind of a part of it. But I'll come back to that. But let me get to the other part of the question, which is, you know, how does it get domesticated? How does it come back? And how is it different in this country when there isn't an uprising or an insurrection? I argue that the way that it comes back is basically through forms of technology and know-how that come back mostly through the military. So a ton of Department of Defense programs that allow police departments, for instance, to buy all of the equipment and all the tanks and all the scopes and the night scopes and the weapons, et cetera, that mean that pretty soon our domestic police departments are starting to look as if they're straight out of some counterinsurgency manual.
Right.
Right.
This is the 1033 program, I think they call it.
Exactly. Right. That's the DOD program that allows the excess property to be bought at a very low cost by police departments that then load up on, you know, armored tank vehicles and night scopes and just the full military gear that all of a sudden you've got, you know. And the pictures when we saw, for instance, the protests at Ferguson or in Baltimore, where all of a sudden you've got civilians in T-shirts facing against what looks as if the military, a police that functionally looks like a military has just walked out of some moat in Afghanistan. Right, so you've got a lot of equipment that's coming back that way. You've got a lot of know-how, right? So what happens is in 2006, General David Petraeus, who's head of operations of in Iraq, and basically rewrites the counterinsurgency manual and distributes it to all of the soldiers. And that 2006 manual was very interesting because it was really was built on the theoretical work of the French and British commanders. David Petraeus is a erudite, scholarly general who had been very infatuated by the French and British counterinsurgency commanders, and who inserted them all over that manual. So it was very much infused by the counterinsurgency in 1950s and 60s. But, of course, that manual then gets distributed to everybody, and all of our brave men and women who are in the army fighting our wars then imbibe it, right? It becomes kind of second nature for everyone. Everyone starts to see the world in this way with, you know, a small insurgent, an active little minority and a passive population and the different strategies and whatnot. And that becomes second nature. And then, of course, as all of those men and women come back to the United States, and many who might end up working in security or police, all of those techniques and know-how become second nature, so that, you know, the police officers who were, say, on a SWAT team are basically deploying the same kind of techniques, right, that have been honed in Iraq and Afghanistan, the same kind of way of dealing with an emergency situation, with a suspect, et cetera, work in the room, all of the movements, all the deployments are basically forms of counterinsurgency warfare. And then you get this kind of creation, but of course there isn't an insurgency in this country, at least I would argue there isn't. So you have the needed fabrication of an internal enemy. And I think we've seen that mostly during the Trump administration as the kind of final iteration of this counterinsurgency paradigm, with the creation of the internal enemy. Muslims, I mean, Trump has really done so much work during his campaign and during his presidency to turn all Muslims and American Muslims into an enemy, an internal enemy. And he's done the same with Mexican Americans, started by calling Mexicans rapists, and with all this business about the caravan. He's been able to kind of convert those into that idea of an active insurgency that we need to repress. And I think that you just saw it perfectly crystallized during the run-up to the midterm campaign, right? Because I mean, you know, that was, since Trump was just beating a drum about this caravan and how dangerous these people were, and of course alluding to the undocumented population in this country, right? And really, I mean, it's as if he ran the whole final stages of the midterm campaign on this counterinsurgency idea of an internal enemy. I mean, it was just remarkable. And of course, after that, you heard so much less about this enemy. But it was clear that it was a way to control the population, right? Of course, it was a way to get people to vote. But it's also just a way to control the population. And much of the distraction mechanisms that he uses, I would say, is a way to kind of win our hearts and minds, or to pacify the American population, because we're spending so much time following who's gotten fired and who's gotten hired and all of the palace intrigue that we really have hardly any time to discuss the substantive issues. You know, when's the last time you heard someone talk about drones and drone, you know, what the innocent lives that are often the collateral consequence of drones? I mean, we don't even talk about that, even though we're using drones more, right, under the Trump administration than we were under the Obama administration. And the Obama administration was pretty much that was their trademark, was drone warfare. But we don't even talk about it anymore because we're just so busy, distracted by the latest tweet and the latest firing.
Obviously, present company accepted, but we do this 5 days a week, and so we have a little more. But yes, as a society, we're not focusing on it. I'm not convinced as a society, frankly, right. We were focusing on
present
it much
company,
during
present company accepted.
Right, right. Yeah. But
there are pockets, and you're.
Right. But I'm not convinced that we were.
Majority Report is you know one of the exceptions, but
we weren't talking about it during the Obama years either, though. I mean, truth be told, and certainly there was a lot more support for the Obama administration than there is, at least apparently now, for the Trump administration. And so and part of that might have been, a part of the dynamic coming out of, sort of major casualties that we were taking during the Iraq War, as opposed to. We're not taking any casualties during the drone war. We're just creating casualties. So I get the we've talked on this program. I think it was Charlie Savage some years ago wrote not a full length book, but an extended essay on the Obama administration essentially legalizing the extrajudicial stuff that the Trump administration did and codifying it in our law. But this sticking point of creating an internal enemy, like Donald Trump, he did this with the caravan, but by any measure other than cable news coverage, he failed, right? I mean, he may be succeeding to a certain extent, but we still have the majority of the country does not accept his premise. I mean, so tell me about that dynamic, because if the theory is that you must convince a passive middle, our middle's not quite as passive. It's passive, but it's not quite as passive as it may have been, frankly, during the Obama years in some respects. And two, he's not doing a good job of that.
Right. Yeah. So this is a really important point you're making. The theory is that the masses are passive in counterinsurgency theory, right? And can be swayed one way or the other, and that they need to be pacified. Now, I don't believe that is actually true of society and of our society, right? We tend to, it gets so internalized, this kind of counterinsurgency paradigm, that pretty soon we're all starting to view the world through it. I mean, that's the most dangerous thing about this way of governing, is that, we start to take it for granted or start to believe it. For instance, we start to believe that there is an insurgency in this country. So when there are certain acts, and most of the extremely violent acts these days are actually unstable individuals, mostly lone wolf, unstable individuals who are then kind of appealing to some ideology, and most of the time now they're appealing to extreme right, white supremacist ideology. But even we don't factor that into this whole counterinsurgency way of thinking. But when we do see acts that then do appeal to ISIS or some extreme fundamentalist, specter of Islam, we then start to believe that there is maybe an insurgency in this country. So one of the most dangerous things about this way of governing and this whole mentality is that we start to see it, we start to believe it, we start to think that it's right. particularly on this question of whether there is an insurgency, right? It's almost once the reasoning is in our mind, then it's easy to kind of project with a dart, you know, one act and say, oh, right, okay, that is the act of minority. But similarly, as you were saying, some start to think that maybe, you know, the masses or the population is passive. I don't actually think it is. And so when we look at what was a remarkable turnout for the last midterm, much more remarkable than in previous midterm episodes, I think you see actually a reflection that it's probably not right to be viewing the world this way, right? But it does have a way of becoming the lens through which a lot of people in this country start to think about what's going on, right?
What strikes me is that the middle, to the extent that we can talk about the middle, but when we're talking about those people, have sort of dubbed themselves the resistance. I mean, to what extent they're resisting is of question, but at least that's the branding, right? And that's a right. lot bigger of a cohort than the small insurgency. But it also occurs to me that on one hand, this resistance, as it were, may be fighting against the Trump administration, but does not seem to have a problem with the paradigm that is existed before the Trump administration and will exist after the Trump administration, right? Like nobody's, the one thing that we're doing is not getting rid of the AUMF. Nobody's talking about getting rid of the Patriot Act. All this stuff is staying put, essentially.
Right. And yeah, and that was the point of the book, and you were entirely right earlier to say that, you know, much of it was written, much of my thinking about it was written thinking that we were going to have a Hillary Clinton administration rather than a Trump administration. I mean, the point of the book is that this is not new to Trump, and what we've seen is since 9/11, the same way of governing in different flavors. Okay, we had the Bush flavor, which was torture, indefinite detention, right? So one of the more brutal forms of counterinsurgency practices, and total information awareness, NSA, and even more, right? Illicit tapping, which was ultimately blocked by Comey, but Ashcross was being asked continue to authorize illicit wiretapping.
But so Mueller was infiltrating Muslim student groups, all around,
right.
In the country.
Right.
Yeah,
I know. I mean, the NYPD in New York City was sending an undercover agent on, you know, whitewater rafting trips by students here.
Yep.
At the City University. I mean, crazy stuff, right? That's right after 9/11.
They were, they were set up in New Jersey. They were set up as far north as Connecticut, Northern Connecticut.
Yeah.
I mean, they were
NYPD
all over the place.
Had this, like, had mapped, like, Newark, yep. all of Newark, with all of the different Muslim populations by nationality, maps that, like, geocoded maps, every single, you know, little halal store, there was a picture of it with a description of how many, you know, 8 seats they had in the store. It was classic counterinsurgency information gathering that was being done. But the important here point, and you made it earlier, right, is that under the Obama administration, the same way of governing continued. It was, again, counterinsurgency. It was just of a different flavor, right? So we turned to drones as a way to knock out that insurgent minority rather than torture and indefinite detention. And we used different policies, but we legalized a lot of this as well under the Obama administration. So we legalized the idea of assassinating an American citizen abroad without without any trial or anything, right? I mean, that's radical when you think about it, and it how contrary it is to the tradition of due process in this country. But that was made possible by a kind of more legalistic, but entirely counterinsurgent mode of governing under the Obama administration. And that's why at the beginning I was resistant to call this a state of exception, because I actually call it a state of legality. We've made everything right. Legal. Even these, you know, even the torture, when you look at the torture memos that went back and forth, right, that was all efforts to make it legal, right, to make the most illegal practice in, you know, international law legal somehow, right? And that's what we've done pretty much over the course of the past pretty soon it'll be two decades. We've legalized these exceptional measures associated with counterinsurgency practices.
So lastly, yeah. how do we reverse this? What is legitimate resistance to this paradigm, not as it's exercised or operated by Trump necessarily, but
right.
You know, Robert Mueller now is like I don't know, some combination of Santa Claus and George Washington, but he certainly was, you know, as an important cog in sort of building this apparatus that you're talking about, at least domestically, in one part of it, as anybody. Right. Barack Obama, you know, put it into a legal framework in many respects. That's what, much of his project was. Some of it was discarded, but the vast majority of it was sort of legalized. What's the plan to change this?
Right. Right. Well, I would say that the first thing we need to do is understand the continuities and understand the underlying logic of the way we're governing today. And that's the project of the book. I mean, in other words, to make people understand that, you know, the Bush administration is instantiating a new variation on this theme, but isn't unique in this way, and that many of the kind of forces from the middle actually have in the past and continue to support this counterinsurgency way of governing. And so I think we need to take a step back. And to, of course, I mean, it's hard to, given the intensity of some of these policies that Trump has put in place, because you're just battling against, you know, the immigration policies, et cetera. So you're so focused on these particular policies, like the Muslim ban or the, you know, a ban on asylums, et cetera. But I think that we need to struggle against those radical policies, but we also need to take a step back and see that it's not simply going back to those policies of kind of sanitized or legalized counterinsurgency that is really going to move us into a political space where we really want to be. Right. Yeah. And so one thing is awareness and raising these issues and talking about them. And then the other is putting in place a more radical approach that not only challenges Trump's excesses, but also challenges the regularity of what we've seen in terms of counterinsurgency policies. That also challenges our foreign policy, the continued use of drones abroad, and that also tries to demilitarize our police forces in this country, and bring us back to more of a community community-oriented way of thinking about how we govern our shared spaces.
Bernard Harcourt, the book is The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam. Talk to you
bye-bye.
Soon. Hope again. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. We will put a link, obviously, to The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens at majority.fm for your reading pleasure. Well, really, your clicking pleasure, and then the reading pleasure is, you know, once. We're trying to facilitate your reading pleasure by providing you clicking pleasure, is the way I would put it.
You know, one of the biographies I wrote once upon a time when I was a staff writer at a biography publication was of Doug Feith, who created a lot of the legal framework for torture during the Bush 2 administration. And I actually got a pissed off letter from him because he had found it and it made him mad. So,
did you say that letter?
I don't think I have it anymore.
Oh, my God. If we had a nickel for every time we say Doug Feith's name. He was in the DOD had set up their own sort of like rival intelligence shop, I think in the basement of the Pentagon, right? And he, because it was basically to put institutional pressure on the CIA to come back with material that said that Iraq was involved in 9/11. And so, look, competition breaks out. The marketplace in this instance, the one client was Dick Cheney. The marketplace wants this intelligence.
Competition would start kicking in.
And competition kicked in and they got what they want more or less. And to the extent that they didn't get what they wanted, they just made sure that it was what they wanted.
Innovation.
Innovation. You have to break some things. So, and here we are. Folks, a reminder, this program cannot and does not exist but for the help of its members. Some of you hear my voice and you're members. And this call lands on your ears as if it's sort of like a, almost like a lullaby. You feel so at home because you have already become a member. So it creates no anxiety. For those of you who are not members, the sound of my voice right now creates a tremendous amount of anxiety.
Hey.
Because you have not become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And for just a couple bucks a week, you can support this show on a daily basis and all our plans for the coming new year. Now, look, oh, I forgot to say this. You guys got to remind me to say this at the beginning of the show. We need your suggestions for best ofs. Best of, if there's like a YouTube clip or something that you saw, or a funny segment, or an interview, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put best of in the subject line. Best of. The word best, second word of, O-F. And help us out.
What do you think was the funniest thing that happened this year?
What do you think was the funniest thing? What was the saddest thing that happened? What was the...
the most WTF.
The most like, yeah, WTF-ish thing. The most... What was the most Michael-ish moment that we had on the show, for instance? I can say that. He's not here today, so... and maybe that's it. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 30% off. I think for a couple more days. Now is the time, folks. If you ever want to try Just Coffee, now is the time to try it. Check out different blends, whatever. 30% off, free shipping. It's tremendous. Now, listen, I don't want to freak you out again, but we are now in the double digits of tickets left. At one point, we had almost 400 tickets available for the January 10th, 13th show. We didn't add a second one. January 13th show at the Bell House, live, Majority Report. Maybe we'll have a guest, maybe we won't. It will just be all of us. Maybe it'll be a guest. I don't know. But we're now in double digits, actually well into double digits, well below triple digits. Let's put it that way. I don't know how to express it. Closer to zero than 100. So in other words, you better do it now. I sort of lied to you. I said maybe it'll sell out by the end of the year. And now it looks like it's going to sell out by before Christmas and maybe even before
the solstice.
The solstice.
Wow. That bodes well, I think.
Yeah.
Check my charts.
Definitely. So it's $15. Maybe that's why. Super cheap. And it's 18 and over. Maybe that's why. Because we get all those 19-year-olds who've been pounding down the doors to see the Majority Report live. But we're working on all sorts of crazy-ass stuff. And just got something in the mail that may force us to make an announcement. I don't know. We'll see. You guys didn't see it. No. But it's sitting there on the couch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's strange. All right, so check that out. And don't forget, tomorrow night, Michael will be back, undoubtedly, because tomorrow's his show. He never misses that show, does he?
It's very healthy on Tuesdays.
It's very weird. We should always just tell him, today's Tuesday. What are you doing? I'm not sure who he has as a guest tomorrow night. But
Matt Taibbi.
Oh, Matt Taibbi is in studio. Matt Taibbi is also very worried about getting sick. So we'll see if he shows. Very, very health conscious. So check out TMBS. You can find it on any place your podcast served or on the TMBS YouTube channel. Jamie's here.
Here I am.
Well, last week you were sick.
I'm still sick, but I'm here anyway.
You got to do something about your health.
Yeah. You need like a body transplant or something. I don't know. Well, maybe just like quit a few of my jobs. I don't know. Not this one. This one pays me the best. But yeah. This week on the Antifada, we still have our last week's episode out where we recap our trip to Mexico, including me and Sean's visit to an autonomous Zapatista community and the amazing libertarian socialist society that they have there. Also, this past weekend, we recorded an episode that'll be out on Wednesday with Justin Akers Chacon, author of Radicals in the Barrio, Magonistas, Socialists, Wobblies, and Communists in the Mexican-American Working Class. And it was really inspired by the bad immigration take by Angela Nagel that people were getting mad about. But this is actually a topic I've been wanting to do for a while. So I'm really glad we got to do it and show how the criminalization of migration actually benefits the capitalist class more than anyone.
There you go.
A new literary hangover this week. It's a nonfiction one for those of you who don't like the fiction focus. It's on Nancy MacLean's Democracy in Chains. We get into which sort of the long history of capital versus democracy and how libertarians have sort of played into that. And I also get into some of the controversy around it, like such as I think uncharitable, I think we could call it, quotation by Nancy MacLean, although I think it's defensible in a certain number of cases that I looked at. So if you've been curious about that book, we kind of go through it fairly in depth. It's about 90 minutes long, so check that out.
There you go. All right, folks. Did you see this? Someone just tweeted me. Did you know this? I did not know this. Pamela Anderson is this true? She's been in a year and a half long romantic relationship with Julian Assange?
Oh, yeah.
No, I didn't know.
No, I had no idea.
I used to be a gossip blogger, and I had to keep track of these things.
Why didn't you tell us? Did it just come up when you were here?
I just thought it was common knowledge. I feel like we've talked about it before, no?
No.
She's like Antifa now. She's been tweeting some very...
Well, no, I've been reading some of her tweets.
Why is she still with Assange?
She's pretty sophisticated, but...
I'm sure she'll move beyond him soon.
Yeah, she's got to graduate beyond
him. Yeah, that makes me a little bit leery of...
Maybe she'll come on Antifada. We can talk about it. We can have a little girl-to-girl talk about her romantic choices.
Pamela Anderson goes in the black block.
Hell yeah.
There you go. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Head back. Fun half. 646-257-3920. See you then. Just reminder. Calming Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged. So you can now sleep better, feel great, and stress less. The Common Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free. Best night's sleep of your life, guaranteed from Sharper Image. And right now, for our listeners, you can go to CommonComfortBlanket.com, all one word, CommonComfortBlanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive 15% off the displayed price. Again, that's CommonComfortBlanket.com, promo code MAJORITY, because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep.